This is Brian Bailey from Charlottesville, Virginia, and I'm joined with Mark Sweeney from Windermere, Florida. We are your guides to this episode of In the Hunt. We are going to bring clarity to this complex game of golf and help you reach your next level of performance. So if you're ready to step up your game, join us on the hunt. Welcome to this week's episode of In the Hunt. This is Brian Bailey here in Charlottesville, Virginia, joined with Mark Sweeney and Windermere, Florida, as always. Hey, Mark, what's going on?
Hey, how's it going? Just been working, teaching loads of lessons this last couple of weeks as people are kind of home from school and taking a break in some places. And so had a great training couple of weeks.
Nice. Europe, I guess, is trying to come back alive from the guys over there. So we wish them all the best of luck. And the United States version of Europe, California, they're not coming alive anytime soon either. So no, I wish them all the best out there as well.
I don't know whether they're playing golf out there or not, though.
I have no
clue. They're certainly not going out to dinner.
Yeah, that is true. Unless you're a politician. And then you can eat at the best places.
A friend of mine went to that place, French Laundry, where the governor got busted. And he's like, yeah, we had dinner there and it was like $4,000 for dinner. It's like ridiculously expensive place.
It's insane.
He's like, it was good, but I'm never doing that again.
Yeah, no, it can't be that good. I'm sorry. No. But today's episode, we're going to do something a little bit fun. We're going to take basically comments and questions we've gotten either on the golf course inside of training or performance questions. So just again, kind of, I guess this is kind of an Uncle Brian, Uncle Mark section where we're going to kind of take the question and tell you what we think. So this is purely like opinion driven by facts inside of GameForge, but really just kind of maybe lifting the veil up to show some insight on sometimes maybe a misunderstanding, maybe a miscommunication, or maybe even a pure falsehood I'm being told to a player. So you want me to start, Mark, or you want to jump in first?
Also, that's a nice way to say the lie.
Well, I was trying to be polite.
Yeah, sure. I'll jump in. I got a good one, and that's why I was thinking the word lie, because I had a player this week who was set up over the ball, eyes over the ball, and aimed it left and missed left. And I was trying to get her to move her eyes inside the ball. And she goes, yeah, but everybody says your eyes have to be directly over the ball. I said, actually, no. I said, actually, it's pretty rare, if ever, that I see somebody's eyes over the ball who putts well. Usually they're inside the ball. And she looks at me and she goes, golf lies. She goes, it's another golf lie. Somebody, we heard it gets perpetuated over and over again. And you just don't know if you don't know. But, you know, anything you do with a training aid, that's a mirror. They're always like eyes over the ball. But, you know, in your experience, Brian, how many great putters or really even good putters you know who set up with their eyes directly on top of the ball?
I can't count a single one, to be honest.
I can't think of a single one either. I'm sure there may be some out there, but I can't in 15 years. I can't think of a single one, maybe one who set up pretty close to the ball, but all the others were inside.
But I've been at many a golf courses watching players taking a ball on the bridge of their nose, getting in position and dropping it and seeing if they can actually hit their golf ball. I have seen countless examples of people setting up that way. And again, you know, it can work, you know, just like anything, but it definitely puts you in a position that can be hard for the rest of the body to move.
Yeah. And the biggest thing I find is, you know, the closer your eyes are to the ball, the more you perceive your aim being to the right. And if you perceive your aim being right, then you twist your putter face left. And the farther you go away from the ball, the more you perceive your aim to be left, and then the more you aim for the right. So as your eyes go closer and farther from the ball, your aim will shift left and right accordingly. And it just seems like the sweet spot for the vast majority of players is kind of eyes over the hosel, you know, inside the ball a little bit, not dramatically, but more over the hosel than directly over the ball. Everybody I see who lines up with eyes over the ball ends up aiming left.
Yeah, like, and the only player I can think of that aimed at their eyes well outside of the ball would have been Michelle Wee when she was trying the tabletop back method of putting.
Yeah,
I mean, her head was way out.
I'm sure there's somebody out there who puts really well like that, but it's so rare. And you know, if you can putt great and aim and you're hit your start line perfectly with their eyes there, go for it, great. But I just, you know, empirically, I just almost never ever see it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. And
their aim.
And golf's hard enough for someone to think that is the, you know, this is the center point of my putting motion, and this is that important. They're definitely going down a pathway where they could pick on better things to improve upon, opposed to maybe where their eyes lay each time they set up.
Yeah, and then if you're closer to the ball aiming left, then you've got to hang on and flare that face open coming through it, you know, almost cut through it to try to get the ball back starting to the right. It's just ugly. It's an ugly stroke. Yeah.
Well, I got it hard
to control.
Well, I got a good text this week from a player, really good player, sends me a video. I'm struggling with short game shots. What's happening? And I was like, well, what are you trying to do? And then she sent me back all this information on what position everything was in, my elbow, face, blah, 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 and just kept hitting me with positions and positions. And I'm like, what are you trying to do? So I think my big thing from the learning area is make sure your attention is where it needs to be, on your intention. There we go. Attention on intention. She didn't know what she was trying to hit. She was so concerned over what was moving, where it was moving, what was going on. She lost fact of to try to hit a little 30-yard pitch shot. What do I need to do to hit that shot? She's played lots of golf. We talked online for 10 minutes, got her to kind of say, well, I was like, at impact, what has to happen? Well, shaft needs to be fairly neutral. Okay. And the video you sent me, was your shaft neutral? No. Okay. What does your path need to be? Well, the path needs to be fairly neutral. I don't want to be inside because I'll get stuck, and I don't want to go outside because it'll make me too steep. Okay. And the video you sent me, was your path where you prescribed it to be? No. Okay. So again, I think we get lost in the golf world, and especially in coaching. A lot of times I would answer that question like, your elbow's here, this is this, and it'll be fixed, but they didn't learn. So basically what I did is I walked her through about a 30-minute text conversation. By the end, she completely solved it. She completely created what she needed to do and started hitting great shots. So again, I think for the player that's learning and trying to understand the game, don't get lost in positions. Don't get lost in all these little nuances. First, know what the shot wants to be and what would help you obtain that shot, and then go chase your positions. I think a lot of times we do the exact opposite. We're so worried about where every position is, we forget what we're trying to do. So I thought that was a really good text message and from a really good player. And then, like I said, the third and fourth video she sent afterwards, she was hitting the crispest little shot. She was so happy. But I think we can end up in the same place. Have you seen that with putting or anything?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I actually had that happen today. And it's something I've seen repeatedly in the past, where sometimes you set up a putt. So I'll tell you the situation today. Taught a good competitive college player today. And we had a fairly difficult, like 18-foot putt, breaking like a three, pretty hard putt. And kept missing and missed a little bit low, missed a little bit short, missed a little bit long. And then she started kind of getting wound up into the position thing. Like, well, you know, am I open at impact? Am I being too quick? And went on and missed maybe 10 in a row, right? And was getting frustrated. And to snap her out of it, I said, okay, here's what's going to happen. You're going to putt, and then I'm going to hit the next putt. And whoever is in first wins. But I promise you, if you hit I'm going to hit a good putt. And she got up there and just absolutely binned it right dead center with the most beautiful shot ever, most beautiful putt ever. And I said, okay, what was different there? And she said, well, as soon as you challenged me and I knew I had one putt to make it, she goes, all my attention went to making the putt, not on positions and where my arm is and where my shoulders are turning and how long my backstroke was. I said, exactly. And what I've seen with good competitive players is the minute you challenge them and say, okay, we're going head to head now, and I promise you, if you give me a chance, I will beat you. They go into a whole different zone where they stop worrying about mechanics and they stop overthinking, and they just go into this box where they're like, okay, I'm going to make this putt, boom. And almost every time they make it, almost without fail.
It's funny. And that, you know, there's a lot of safety on a putting green. There's a lot of safety in training. And for a lot of you that have this, just understand that training is getting you ready for the golf course. And don't fall for the big sleeping beauty over there that I'm so worried about these mechanical pieces and stuff. Make sure it's inside of training that you're actually putting pressure, understanding what needs to happen, and attacking inside of training as well. Because I think there's probably the major disconnect, I would say, in golf is the way players train versus the way that they compete. And I think, you know, I think these are both really good examples of they were getting lost and not what they were trying to do by hitting a shot or hitting a putt. They were getting lost and just thoughts of outside. And again, once you kind of redefine the action, again, high end players, they quickly snap right back to what works. So be wary player, be wary coach that you don't mess that up.
Yeah. And I think that's so why it's so important to, while you're practicing, try to get some sort of competition going. And a lot of lessons I do at some point, I'm saying, okay, we're going head to head now. You get one putt, I get one putt, first one in wins. But gets them out of that mechanical motion, what's happening, into, okay, this is what it's all about. We both have birdie putts, and I, you know, if you leave it short, I'm going to beat you, right? If you're just handing me the win, if you leave this birdie putt short, which we can get to next, but it really gets them into, I got one shot to beat this guy on this hole, take it. And you're not going to do that by sitting there worrying about, you know, where your elbow is.
Yeah. And so, you know, what's exciting though, as a coach, is you get posed hundreds and hundreds of questions a year. And I encourage you to journal and write these down and really think on these. Your players give you great insight. And again, to make you as a better coach. But yeah, definitely challenging them, putting them in performance situations more so than, you know, let's hit a number on a box or let's make sure the ball is, you know, doing this one thing. Always challenge them and try to simulate golf where you can. So do you want to switch to performance here, or do you want to stay on the putting green there, Mark?
Well, on the putting green, since we just mentioned a second ago, you know, one thing I've heard three times in the last week was, you know, 15 to 20 feet, people are saying, well, you're not really trying to make those, right? You're trying to two-putt from there. And every time I'm like almost falling over on the putting green, hitting my head, I hear this from juniors, I hear from college players, I hear from adults, and I'm like, listen, you know, as a amateur, college, you know, even as a tour player, up to 90% of your birdies are coming 20 feet in, but you only get one or two of those around inside 10 feet. So all the rest have to come 10 to 20 feet, you know, in our IP range. How can you not be needing and wanting to make those? Like, that's the only way you're getting below par, is if you start making those, right? And so your speed's got to be good, your reach's got to be good, everything's got to be good there. But no, 20 feet is not a two putt and leave putt. 30 feet, yeah, okay. 20 feet, no chance. You've got to take advantage. Anything inside 20 feet is a good approach. Tour players have seven around on average, right? You get seven shots out of 18 to make birdie, and most of those will be, you know, 10 feet plus. So yes, you need to focus on making those, especially if you're on a win. You got to make four or five, even six birdies around. You got to get on it.
Yeah, and I like the caveat you were saying, juniors and collegians and adults. You don't hear it from touring professionals, because if you're a touring
professional, you don't. They know better.
and you're not making putts, you're not a touring professional.
You're go make 25 putts a tournament, 24 putts. I mean,
you're on a very small mini tour somewhere and talking about being professional. You're not on TV on the weekends.
That's exactly right. Have you seen that with people? Have you seen I'm so far from the hole at 20 feet and it's not that far from the hole.
No, I agree. I had a tour player in last week, and we actually created a drill. Mark and I created a drill when he was up here a couple weeks ago. I put her through that, because what we're noticing inside of assessments, so we're assessing it and challenging her game. We noticed at distances, she was leaving putts short at that distance. And I'm like, we've got to get 2 feet past the hole on average. We've got to start pushing this. So we laid out a putting drill that we'll share with everybody here in the future. And from that drill, she played immediately after our lesson, and actually made, I think, two or three putts between 18 and 25 feet. And she said, just the visual of what we laid out and knowing that she had to get the ball to the hole, because this is still a scoreable way, she walked away with three birdies, where she probably normally wouldn't have walked away with any. So again, that's that the concept. I think a lot of times the concept is, if you're told something and you believe it and it's not completely true, how does that affect your game? Like, I hear a lot, you know, 20 feet out is a two putt game. Not if you want to win.
Yeah. I mean, even 20 to 40 feet, I mean, tour players are making 10%. I mean, they're still making one out of 10 out there, right? They're not just two putting and leaving, you know, outside 40 feet. Yeah. They're not making many putts out there, but they're not three putting either. They're making three putting once every two rounds, you know, and that's it.
Yep.
Right. So, but 20 feet in, man, that's go time.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, because I think there's a lot of stories and a lot of things saying, well, statistically, you know, don't spend a lot of time there because it doesn't matter. I agree. You know, you're not going to sit outside at 40 feet for 7 to 8 hours a week trying to make those putts, but having a good concept, a good read, good speed, and having all the pieces that match what needs to happen, you'll make a couple of those putts.
Sure. So, make one so every again, day I'm out there.
Yeah, don't
put those every day on the putting grid. I'm always make one.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you never hit it close, so that's kind of when you
exactly. I have to make those.
You have to make those. And again, I think another thing I listen a lot to it, and most of my lessons and stuff nowadays, I'm doing a lot online, computer, doing a lot of phone calls, see random people here there, but I get a lot of requests on, you know, what do I need to do? Who do I need to see? How can I make this better? So I guess this would be a performance question that I get is, who do I need to go see to make me X level next? Right. So we have Game Forge. It's giving you all this great information. What do I need to do? And I think a lot of players, and I think a lot of mainly players, but even college coaches fall in this, they look for fairy dust. They send a player somewhere around the world. The player goes to this esteemed, you know, great coach. They do a generic lesson for a couple hours.
Couple thousand dollars.
Yeah, whatever the fee is. And what do they really learn from it? So I guess to me, understanding performance is, if you're into performance and you want to get somewhere, you got to find the right coaches. And I use the word coach. So again, I have I just know players that end up, they see these actions that are not good enough, and then they make these harebrained schemes and go see a dad of a future player of a, you know, some weird like Spaceballs, I'm your father's dad's cousin, you know, and they're my golf coach because, and so to me, what it is as a player, you have to have ownership of what you do. I always tell my players they're a corporation in themselves. All your coaches are kind of subsidiaries to Player Inc. And I think that ownership part is really important. Even falls back on the lesson we talked about, right? You got to take ownership of what shot am I trying to hit? Let's put everything in order to hit that shot. And same thing is if I want to advance, I want to go play college golf. I need to find that coach that can take me from the level I'm at. That's going to move me to help me move to the level I'm going, but it really falls back on you, the player. You must own this. You must understand this. You must take control of all this and get you to that next step. Now, the beauty of a junior is you have a parent, hopefully, that's going to be sitting there and driving a lot of the narrative and helping you. But as you're progressing, when you get to college, you have college coaches that are going to have information. They're going to try to make you better. They're going to give you stuff. But again, you must own what you're doing again and keep moving forward. So I guess the frustration that I have with a lot of players is they don't take ownership for what's happening. They're taking ownership. You know, so to me, the ownership is about, I'm trying to hit a 30-yard pitch. What's happening? What do I need to do? Where's my shaft lean? Where's my grip? Where's my stance? What turn am I trying to do? What am I trying to do to achieve this shot? That's owning what you do. I don't think, you know, I think a lot of people think of swing by numbers. My coach tells me to hit this shot and I just hit this shot, or I just don't know what shot to hit when I'm sitting here. That's not an excuse. It's your game. You can't have your caddy. So what are your thoughts on players taking ownership? And really where this was spun off from is one, the phone call I took, but I did a little presentation with a player overseas. And then I did this whole breakdown of his golf game. And I go, what's the number one thing you pulled away from this entire meeting? He goes, I need to challenge my coaches better. And I gave him some great nuggets of information on performance, but his number one piece was,
made a bunch of enemies with coaches in Europe. That's for sure.
That's right. And his number one feedback was, I need to challenge my coaches more. And to me, I was as giddy as a school kid right there. Any thoughts on that, Mark?
Yeah. I mean, I tell you what's hard for players is that if you don't know who the good coaches are, you don't know. I mean, there's a lot of coaches who have big names or are very well known, have good reputations, or, you know, I don't even know if it's good reputation. They're just known coaches. And so a lot of players will just by default say, okay, well, they can't be all bad. Let's go see them. And they may or may not be helped. You know what I mean? And the problem with the one-off lesson is it's just a one-off lesson. The player, regardless of whether they end up getting lucky and getting the right coach for themselves, it's still their responsibility. And if they're not getting the results they need to challenge their coach. And if the coach can't get it done, they need to move on. You know, that's just a fact. Even if the coach is telling them the right thing, but the player's not able to, it's still the player's responsibility to improve their performance. And so whether they just don't sync up or whatever, the player needs to, you know, say, hold all their coaches responsible. And you're right, it's all their coaches. I think we're well past the days of a player having a single coach that teaches them everything. I think those days are gone or should be long gone. Then you say, here's the numbers I need to hit. Here's the performance metrics I need to hit. Let's work on that. Let's make sure we're seeing a trend line moving in the right direction. And if not, the question is, why not? And if your coach can't give you an answer, I mean, I know what a coach is going to say. They're going to say, well, because you're not doing what I tell you to do, right? I mean, that's the coach's answer. But the player, as a player, you have to ultimately say, am I improving or not? Whether it's their fault, my fault, whatever, it doesn't matter. Am I improving or not? If not, we need to make a change. But ultimately, nobody cares about your game more than you do yourself. Your coaches might care a lot, but it's your game, it's your life, it's your income if you're a pro golfer. And so you got to own it, and you've got to understand what your metrics are, and you have to understand what it takes to play at a certain level. And if your coach can't tell you that, you need to go find somebody who can tell you that, because it's very clear. Like, we know what it takes, but we don't know a whole lot of players who really understand that.
No, I agree. And this is fascinating. I just got an Instagram question. So someone's question's coming right into the game, right into the show here in a second. So,
a live show.
Yeah, no, I think the beauty of it again is, and I saw this collegiately where players are like, we're like, something needs to change. The numbers aren't getting bad. And they're like, well, I have such a relationship with the coach, I don't want to change.
Well, and that's hard, you know, because you know how sensitive that can be. You know, when you leave, when a player leaves a coach, there's usually hard feelings in there. So that can be a difficult thing.
No, I agree. But in your journey, you know, there's going to be people that are going to be there to help you at different levels and at different steps. And different coaches are designed at different points to be able to do that. So, you know, I guess my number one point of advice for anyone that's aspiring their next level is, if the coach isn't getting it done, and you know, you got to start finding elsewhere. But the only way you can really do that is truly know your game and understand where you're lacking and what needs to be improved upon. So I challenge all of you out there listening right now, as a player that's kind of sitting here in the winter months, you got 4 months before major tournaments start showing up again. You know, here's good time for self-reflection. And what do I need to accomplish in the next 4 months to get me where I want to go?
Yeah, and there's some trial and error. I mean, I hate to say it, but just because somebody has a great reputation as a coach doesn't necessarily mean they're going to help you, or doesn't necessarily mean y'all are going to get along. So, you know, I think referrals are very important, but I've seen referrals go very badly. I've seen a few people get referred from a friend, and I was like, yeah, and they suffered from it. So,
well, yeah, but yeah,
always, good luck out there.
Yeah, no, it's hard because there's a lot of coaches teaching lots of different stuff, and maybe, you know, what they're teaching you doesn't really fit the way you move or way you think, and it's not a good fit. But again, that's part of the journey is finding the right fits, you know. And I would even say, kind of, you know, as a player, what do you want from your coach? Do you want one that's, you know, do you want a cheerleader? Do you want a harsh reality speaker? You know, what do you want? Do you want sarcasm? Do you want politeness? You know, those are all pieces that make the mold. And well, if you come and see Mark and I, you're definitely going to get straight answers, and you're definitely going to get sarcasm.
100%, you're gonna get that. So don't be too sensitive.
Don't be sensitive. You, yeah, roll
you might get answers you don't want to hear, but they're gonna be the truth.
They will be the truth, but and we'll find it funny. No, I'm kidding.
That's right.
But we will. So this is funny. I've gotten this question now twice in the last 2 weeks. What the heck is BIP?
BIP is a very people don't quite understand BIP. So BIPs is birdies to in position. So it's a ratio of how many birdies you make based on how many in positions you have. And the easy but not quite accurate way to think about it is how many putts you're making. So if you have 10 in positions and you make 5 birdies, you say, okay, well, I made 5 out of 10 birdie in position putts, therefore my BIP is 50%. And that's largely true, but some of the BIPs come from outside of 20 feet. Right. So the way to really think about BIPs is it's a measure of how productive you were with your round based on your ball striking. So if you only had 2 in positions and made 2 birdies, you had 100% BIP. You were very productive generating birdies from a weak ball striking day. If you had 15 in positions and made 2 birdies, you're going to have a I don't even know what that is, like a 7 or 8% BIP, which is terrible, which means you were very unproductive. It means if you were just average productivity there, you would have made, you know, 7 to 8 birdies, but you only made 2. So I like to look at it as, given the relative strength or weakness of that day's ball striking, how much did I capitalize it and generate birdies? And sometimes you see BIPs over 100%. You see somebody have 5 in positions and make 6 or 7 birdies. So they had a long putt or a chip in or a hole out or something. But to me, it's a productivity measurement, a birdie productivity measurement. Do you look at it any different from that, or do you have any tweaks on that?
No, same way. It's just, to me, it's just like a little comprehensive what happened with ball striking in relationship to putting in one number. It's just a trend setter, right? When I look at total birdies, I look at BIP, it gives me a good idea of what happened in ball striking. Like you said, if you had 2 birdies and I look at it, you know, an 100% BIP, I can immediately know that your in positions are going to be really, really low because you only made 2 birdies.
I've seen cases of players shooting 69 with a very low BIP, which means, well, yeah, they shot 69, but they should have shot 65. Exactly. They hit the ball well enough to shoot 65. So the day wasn't a bad scoring day, but it wasn't a productive day. It could have been much better, but they just didn't convert.
Yeah, no. So, yeah, so I think a lot of people get confused on the BIP, and some just don't know what it is, like the Insta chat I just got. But the concept, again, it's just a kind of a performance piece. It just kind of shows you putting or birdies made in relationship to ball striking. Just a good comprehensive what happened today.
And that climbs as you get to be better and better, more higher levels of golf. That goes from 20% up to the pro levels, I guess, to 60%. Average, even up to winners are at 75-80%.
Yep.
You know, so as you get better and better, one of the reasons is because you're converting a higher number of your opportunities. And as you're more productive, as you're converting at a higher amount, your scores will go down generally.
Exactly. And you had I think one last topic on the putting green.
Yeah, the other one I want to talk about, because I get asked about this almost on a weekly basis, especially when we do aim point training, is why can I still walk to the other side of the ball? Should I still walk to the other side of the ball? Is it good? Is it bad? Whatever. I don't ever do it. And I know people do it. I don't mind walking under the line for distance to see how long it is at a different angle, like, you know, perpendicular to your line. But I really, really don't like going to the far side of the ball for a number of reasons. Number one is, all the information you need is found in that middle area of the putt, which we feel. Okay, fine. You go to the other side of the ball, and the problem there that I've run into is that the slope you're feeling on the far side of the ball can be very different than the slope the ball is running across. And so you're standing there and you say, well, I'm just looking down my line. But whether you like it or not, you're still feeling the ground under your feet. And I've seen situations where the ball breaks right to left, and then you go to the opposite side and you get an opposite break and your feet are turned or tilted the other way, and you feel that, and then you get confused, like, well, I thought it was right to left over here, but now I don't think so anymore. So what have we done? We've introduced contradiction, or you know, two reads that don't agree with each other, which is the last thing you need when you're putting, because then you either have to discard one of them or you have to kind of blend them together, which is also a very bad idea.
Aim straight, hit hard.
Yeah. So, you know, and the other thing is, you know, we really don't want to use the opticals. There's so many well-known optical illusions out there with putting that are largely dependent on the surrounding terrain, and that whether it's mountains or just the mounding around the green, you know, green architects are very, very good at creating mounding that confuses you about which direction the putt goes. And a lot of that's on purpose, right? So there's a very well-known optical illusion that can be reproduced easily called, what is the name of it? I just blanked out, but it's basically when you have flanking slopes, I think it's called. So when you have the mounding behind the green, let's say going right to left, and then the slope of the green itself is subtly left to right. And I've got lots of examples of this just in my course in Orlando. Your brain flips the direction. Your brain works on the predominant slope, which is the bigger slope behind the green, which is the mounds, and anything less than 3%, your brain will actually flip the direction of it to the wrong direction. And so guess what? All our hole positions are usually 3% or less. So they've proven scientifically that when you get these conflicting slopes of a bigger slope and a smaller slope, especially when the smaller slope is less than 3%, your brain flips it, moves it the other direction. And so that's a big problem when you're trying to get your slope correct down to 1% or 0.5% even. If you feel it, you'll feel it correctly. But the minute you let your eyes take over, then you get all these external influences that can really screw that up. And so I like to minimize those as much as possible. And going to the far side of the hole and looking back down your line is a great way to introduce external influences that don't actually affect the putt, that are going to, but they're going to affect your perception of what the putt does.
So the flanking slope is why my putt actually went uphill.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I have a great video on my YouTube site from Mike Weir at the U.S. Open in Bethpage. And I don't know if it was 02 or the one after that. But anyway, you're watching this putt, and he's got like a 10, 12 foot birdie putt. And the slope behind him is a very clean right to left. And so if you're looking at it on TV, you're like, oh, that ball's breaking left. No question. He plays it outside right and it breaks right. And they go, wow, he got the direction wrong on that. And the other announcer says, every player has wanted that putt to go left and it just doesn't. And it's very clear that, you know, the mounding behind it gets your eyes thinking right to left, but the subtle slope in the green itself is actually the opposite direction and nobody sees it correctly. You can't see it correctly because we're not physiologically wired to see that correctly. You have no chance of seeing it correctly. But if you stood over there and walked it and stepped on it like we would with aimpoint, you go, oh, that actually goes right. And then you'd have much easier time playing a left to right break there.
Now, at the University of Virginia's short game facility, they let me use it still. Very nice. Well, they've actually rebuilt it, but one of the greens actually had that exact putt where it looked like it was breaking right to left hard. And then you would actually go put your, you know, I used to take people inside of aimpoint and I'd take a $20 bill, drop it on the ground and say, here's an 8 foot putt. If you make this, you can keep the 20. And nobody ever made the putt because, again, you saw the visual going one way. There's a subtle slope that was taken in the opposite. Only one person in my probably 8-10 years of teaching on that green actually put their feet on it. And I thought I was going to lose my $20.
They
actually hit the putt correctly, but missed it. But everyone else, it was never close because they were always on the wrong side of the hole. But yeah, no, yeah. Those visuals are there. Definitely.
Well, there's another great visual that you get in the mountains, which is called the height of the horizon. So if you're looking at a green that has a big mountain behind it, we have what's called a high visible horizon. It'll make the green look more slopey. And if you have a low horizon, mm-hmm. So sometimes you get up to these greens where there's a big drop off behind it, whether it's a mountain or a hill or even just an elevated green, anytime the green drops off behind it, it looks flatter than it really is. And it's a very well-known illusion that golfers tend not to know, but I've been in lots of these situations. And there's one, this great one, the Broadmoor, one of the early holes of the Broadmoor, the whole valley is on the left side and it just drops off. The entire, you know, plane drops off really far and it looks like a fairly flat green. And you get up to the whole thing's like 4% right to left. It's like this massively pitched green, but it doesn't look like it because of the low horizon on the left side makes it look tilted a little bit the other way. It makes it look flat. And so these are, you know, if you're aware of these, you can overcome them very easily, but that's, you know, that's another problem. If you're looking both sides of the putt, you know, one of those directions might have a high or a low horizon, which is going to completely skew your perception of slope.
So what you're telling me is the only way to really read putts is go to put your feet on it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm telling you.
and
keep your eyes down. Stop looking for stuff.
That's right. You go to aimpointgolf.com and learn how to do that more proficiently.
Aimpointgolf.com. I will promise you, I will not teach you to look for anything.
Oh, very good.
So I will not be teaching you to look at surrounding terrain or low points on the property or rivers or creeks.
Or magical creeks that draws everything to this one point.
The fairies in the creek are attracting your golf balls.
That's right. And a good read. I don't know if these are still out there, but I remember you used to put a couple writings out every once in a while where you said, I'm your golf ball. I don't have eyes.
Yeah.
I can't see. I think that if you search.
Yeah, it's on my blog.
Blog.
Yeah. I'm your golf. Yeah.
Go read. That's a good one.
The golf ball has no perception other than feeling where it's sitting on the ground, the point of contact, is it tilted or not tilted? That's it. There's no other perception, quote, that the ball has.
Well, yeah, but it's got it's so being dragged that way, by another mythical force outside of gravity and slope.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is people are like, oh, you know, the ocean pulls the ball. But the facts of gravity are that ocean has less gravitational pull than mountains do. So if anything, the mountain should be pulling your ball. Oceans are a low gravitational force area and mountains are in high density places are a bigger gravitational force area. So it's actually opposite if you look at real physics.
Awesome. So I'll actually put this as a science podcast.
Yeah, why not? Who cares? Why not?
All right. So we're going to wrap up here. I am going to look at Christmas lights tonight with the family. We're going to head out of here in a couple minutes. So is there anything you want to do to wrap up here, Mark?
No, just keep cracking away. The weather in Florida is beautiful. Spent a lot of time outside and a lot of people really trying to tidy up their game right now during the off season, the holiday season. Been doing a lot of speed control work. You know, once the read's good and line's pretty good, there's so much speed control work to do. And I think that's neglected a lot by people. So keep cracking away on that. Every single day you practice, you should be doing speed control work.
All right, I'm back. Yeah, so reach out to us on Instagram, shoot us a letter. I'll edit this. You won't have a clue what I'm talking about. But thank you guys again for listening. Thank you so much. And we look forward to future podcasts with you.
Thank you.